What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off.
Mark Jeffrey is the co-founder and CEO of Guardian Circle, a service tackling emergency response through a unique community approach. He's also a serial entrepreneur with five exits, a published author, and worked closely with some of the biggest names in tech, including Jason Calacanis and Travis Kalanick. In this conversation, we discuss how emergency response can improve, why disbanding the police probably won't happen, what it has been like to work with some of Silicon Valley's most successful entrepreneurs, and the experience of building a company during COVID-19. I really enjoyed this conversation with Mark, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into the episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. The first is Blockset by BRD. You'll know BRD as one of the first blockchain wallets in the App Store back in 2014. They've now built Blockset, which is essentially the Amazon AWS for the blockchain industry. It's a hosted blockchain infrastructure product. Blockset enables enterprises and developers around the globe to deliver high-quality blockchain-based applications in a fraction of the time at a fraction of the cost. Using the services provided by Blockset, businesses can build professional custody solutions, accurate and near real-time portfolio management solutions, auditing platforms, commercial block explorers, and much, much more. Go check them out at blockset.com. The next is crypto.com. It's an all-in-one platform that allows you to buy, sell, store, earn, loan, and invest crypto all from one place. You can join over 1 million users currently using the crypto.com app. That's right, they got a million people to download the crypto.com app. You can download it today and earn $50 using my code POMP2020 or click on the link in the description. Crypto.com, not only do they have a cool URL, but it's also the place where mass adoption is happening. Lastly, don't forget that I write a daily letter to over 50,000 investors about business, technology, and finance. I break down complex topics into easy-to-understand language while sharing my opinion on various aspects of each industry. You can subscribe at pompletter.com. Again, pompletter.com, or go in the description and you can click the link there. All right, let's get into this episode with Mark. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. Super excited to have Mark here. Thanks so much for doing this, man.
Really glad to be here. Thanks for asking me on.
Yeah, for sure. Let's start with just your background. Like, where'd you grow up and what'd you do kind of before you got into technology?
I grew up in New Hampshire, so kind of in the woods. My dad was a software engineer, so we had, you know, TRS-80s and Apple IIs and things like that in the house. So that was super cool. So became a software engineer when I got out of school, worked in the defense business for a little while and decided that was not for me. Didn't like working in a lead room, not in the entrepreneurial world. So then I went to Delphi Internet for a little bit. That was kind of a cool thing that got me out to LA. And I had an office right next door to Sean Connery and I showed him the internet for the very first time, which is a pretty funny story. And I started my first company, a thing called The Palace, which was this avatar virtual chat in like 96. So very early. And it was funded by SoftBank, Time Warner and Intel. And it was pretty big. It had about 10 million users at its peak, which for those days was just enormous. Right. So that ended up, there was no business model though, right? Nobody knew how to make money off of these things. We now know the answer would have been NFTs, right? Inside of a virtual world, but we didn't have that back then. And we didn't even have payment rails. Like there was no PayPal, the credit card process. We just had no way to do that stuff. So great phenomenon, but not really a business, but did sell it. So that was cool. And then did my second company, which was a thing called SuperSig, which was putting all kinds of functionality into email signatures. And that, you know, we raised like $2.5 million for like Ron Conway and some of those folks, up in Silicon Valley. I'm in LA, so up north. And, that was my crash company. So unfortunately that one didn't work out. And then a friend of mine, came to me and said, well, I have a company that's sort of on the ropes. You're completely on the ropes. Why don't you come work for me for a little bit? And, so I said yes. And that friend was Travis Kalanick. and later CEO and founder of Uber. He was working on his second company at the time, a thing called Red Swoosh. So I did that with him for about a year, year and a half, something like that. It was like maybe four to six of us in a little kind of cramped office in Westwood for about a year and a half. So he ended up selling that company, but like 8 years later, right? So, and it didn't, it really did not look like it was going to go anywhere for a very long time. So,
the story that I've heard about Red Swoosh is he basically, everyone had left, moved on to do other things, and he just was persistent as hell. And then out of nowhere, a bunch of investors started getting checks. And they were like, what the hell is this from? And he was like, oh yeah, I sold the company.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. And you know, I ran into him, I talked to him again in sometime around 2014, 2015. And I was very interested in what was up with Uber, obviously, but I was really more interested. I was like, how the hell did you sell that company, right? And it really was just a story of grit. I mean, that's absolutely true. And that is Travis. So I give him that. The real story that I've heard is that Akamai acquired another company that was in sort of an adjacent space, and they got a patent portfolio with that company. Red Swoosh had a patent that threatened that patent portfolio. So out of abundance of caution, they acquired Red Swoosh as well, not for its business, because there were no engineers. There were no engineers, there was no product, there were no customers. That's why I was like, this is crazy. And so, you know, he had something to negotiate with, and it was the patent. So it wasn't just sort of nothing. But he was able to negotiate a much larger exit than probably another mere mortal would have been able to do, right? Because that is Travis. So
that's awesome. And then what did you do after Red Swoosh?
Yeah, so after Red Swoosh, I was stupid enough to start another company. And this one was a business social network. So yes, we were a competitor to LinkedIn. We started in 2002. We didn't know about LinkedIn yet because they hadn't publicly unveiled themselves. They were about 6 months ahead of us, so not terribly far. We couldn't raise money for it. So we ended up getting to about 1 million users when LinkedIn had 2 million. So, you know, we were within shooting distance. And then IAC, Barry Diller Interactive Corp, they basically acquired us through a long sort of story, but they ended up acquiring us in 2004. And then, you know, we didn't know how we made money. It was another one of these things. It was a great phenomenon, but nobody knew how to make money off social networks in those days. And it could have been a lot of things, right? Now we know what the answer is, but looking forward from these moments, those answers aren't clear. It could be you charge people to post, right? Or it could be it's free, but you give us your email address and we're allowed to email market to you. There were a lot of people doing things like that back then. So Diller came to us and said, great, I've acquired you. I love what you're doing. It's awesome. But all of my companies are either number one or number two in their category. So you have to pick a category of revenue and become number one or number two in that category within a year. So I said, all right. So I kind of went away for about a month to try to figure this out. And I ended up I hired Charlene Lee, who is now pretty well known as an analyst. So I worked with Charlene a lot on sort of these ideas. And I came back and I said, look, it's jobs. It's Monster just inside of a social network. And you use your social graph as a way to find better candidates or better jobs that you have connections to. Again, this was not obvious sort of, it is looking back. It wasn't from that moment looking forward. So we went and presented it to Diller. And this is before LinkedIn decided to do the exact same thing. So we presented Diller. Diller says, he said, basically, look, he agreed that it was Monster.com, but Monster spent $100 million a year on advertising. So he was like, I would have to spend $100 million a year on advertising. And we were like, no. Look at the we had the growth curve. We did have, you know, the storied, you know, curve going up and to the right. And we said things like geometric growth. We didn't have the word viral growth yet. That wasn't in the lexicon. And it wasn't really sort of commonly understood. So we're describing viral growth to him, but we don't have the words yet. And he just thinks we're full of shit. He thinks this is just some shit we've cooked up. And to his credit, though, there's nothing in his experience that maps to a phenomenon like this, right? He comes from a world where you spend money on advertising and then people come, right? And so he wasn't wrong. He just didn't have anything to sort of relate to it. So he basically said, I don't believe this. He said, well, come up with something else. And I said, there is nothing else. this is the right answer. And then there's all the wrong answers. And so basically he was like, well, I'll buy you guys out your contracts then. And that was kind of that. So I left. And then I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. Oh, I started writing novels. I did that. And I podcast some of the novels. I was one of the first people to podcast a audiobook. I was one of three. So we all of us ended up getting like millions of downloads because we were the only free audiobook novels in the world at the time. And then iTunes added podcasting support. So all of a sudden we were the only game in town. Right. So, and that's a whole nother. So yeah, that was this book. This book here, which ended up getting published by HarperCollins. So that was a whole nother little adventure I went on. So I was thinking about doing another tech company and I didn't really have a good idea. I was piddling around with a couple of things. And I got a call from Jason Calacanis and he basically said, hey, I got a term sheet from Sequoia to do this new wave search engine called Mahalo. And I'm looking for a CTO, you know, what are you doing? And, it seemed like a good idea at the time. So I signed up. And really, it was a good idea at the time. We were basically saying humans were curating search results. At the time, Google's search results looked very sort of robot-y, and there wasn't really much meat there. So you know how today there's like little side card that comes down that shows you kind of a summary of whatever it was you were just searched for? That wasn't there yet. Mahalo was doing that, and except we were trying to, you know, human curate it on a much larger scale. So we were right. The searches could be vastly improved with some human intervention. But the problem was that, you know, we would have had to compete successfully with Google. To do that, we would have had to have a corpus of data that was competitive with Google. And it took so long to make search results by hand that after a year, we had like 5% of the internet done, right? Or 5% of all search results. And so basically the end result was 95% of the time, Mahalo sucked. 5% of the time, it was 600% better, right? But that just didn't really work in the end. So we did, you know, I worked on that for about four years. Elon Musk was an investor, so got to meet him, got to hang out with him. And, you know, Sequoia was an investor. So there's some great people hanging around in the Mahalo offices. It was kind of like Warhol's loft for a little while. So a lot of really interesting and great people and ideas kind of flowed through that office, at least in LA. It was kind of the center of action for about 4 years. Long story short is then Jason and I started talking and Kevin Pollak started hanging around a lot, the comedian. And Kevin, yeah, he's great. I love Kevin. And so Jason knew from my podcasting days that I was very into podcasting and knew that world. And so he said, look, let's do a podcasting company. We'll call it This Weekend, and you can be CEO and we'll all be three-way partners on it. So we started that and I did that for about a year and a half. And long story short is we just couldn't make it profitable. It was just, there was too much diversity in the shows. They were all over the map. So that meant we had to sell ads against, we had 30 shows and we really had 30 different markets. So we could gain those sales efficiencies. They all had very different demographics. And some of the shows were too broad, like This Week in Music, for example. One week it was speed metal, the next week it's classic rock, next week it's rap. Those are completely different audiences, so it could never sort of find its groove. The tech shows did very well. So Jason's show, This Week in Startups, that did awesome. We had, there was one I hosted called This Week in Cloud Computing. We had like a This Week in iPad. We were sort of following a lot of the model that Leo Port had laid out, right? So tech shows worked, the other shows kind of didn't. So we were sort of left in this no man's land. So after about a year and a half, Jason said, you know, I think I can make a run at it. So he took a crack at it. He couldn't make it work either. But I left. And then I again was sort of like, I'm not sure what I'm going to do. So I consulted for a little bit. I just went to local VCs. And I said, sort for hire, you know, what do you need? What do you need help with? So I did that for, I was like a Ronin for about 2 years. And then I had the idea for Guardian Circle, which is the current thing that I'm doing right now. So anything else in the past you want to talk about?
Here's my question is, you have worked on many companies that people who pay attention to technology, especially over the last 20 years or so, will know a number of those companies, a number of those players that ran companies, founded companies. What's your biggest lesson learned through all of that? Right, whether it comes from the people, the companies, like what would you say is the biggest lesson you learned through that whole timeline?
Yeah, there actually is a biggest lesson, oddly. And I learned it when I was at Mahalo, and Mike Moritz, who is, you know, fabled Sequoia partner, founder, came to visit us one day, and he had like a Q&A, ask me anything session. And I asked him the question. I said, look, you have like 30 years, it was either 30 or 40 years of venture capital experience at the time. You've seen a lot of stuff. What's the difference between the companies that make it and become big things like Apple and Google, and the companies that just die? And I really thought the answer was going to be something like, well, it depends. There's a lot of things, a lot of factors. And he said, oh, that's easy. The companies that focus on one thing and one thing only and are the best in the world at one thing have a shot at being the Apple or the Google. I can't tell you that for sure they will, but they at least now have a lottery ticket, and a lot of times they do win. The companies that definitely fail every time are the ones that can't pick a direction, right? They're like, oh, we should, oh, there's money over an enterprise, so let's forget our consumer thing and go over here, right? They sort of get distracted by all these siren songs around them, and those are the companies that die. And if you're, you know, pivoting, like, you know, so much you're doing pirouettes, like, you're definitely going to die. And that's the pattern that he's seen. So that's sort of A. B, I would, this is not a direct lesson of mine, but when I heard this, it rang very true. There's a guy named Bill Gross, who founded Idea Lab, and he has 30 years worth of data from that, where he analyzed, so they did a study where they analyzed what is the difference between the companies that make it and the companies that don't. He did his own sort of, you know, qualitative, quantitative study. Is it the team? Is it the amount of money? Is it the quality of the idea? You know, where's the magic? And the answer was very surprising and very clear. The answer was timing. Almost nothing else mattered. The biggest coefficient of a company's success is timing. And there was absolutely no question about this. So that was a pretty surprising, but very clear finding.
Yeah, it's really interesting too how when you talk to these folks who have been around for decades, right, and they've seen everything come through the door, they can boil it down to one thing, right? It's not just, it is this complex answer. It's like, no, like, here is the thing from my experience that matters the most. And what that really tells you is it's like they've got the clarity of thought and they really do understand it, right? It's kind of the adage of like, if you don't really understand something unless you can explain it to a child, like, they're able to boil it down to here is the one thing that matters.
Yeah, no, I know. And I have to say, I'm guilty of, you know, look, we're founders. We fall in love with our products, right? This is a thing that I thought of. I'm super happy about it. And when I'm telling you about it, I want to, you know, to me, it's fucking Lord of the Rings, right? And I want to take the time to craft the story, but you don't give a shit. You have a million people coming to you. You just want me to get to the point right away. And also you want the customer to get the point right away, because the customer's going to listen for like 3 seconds and, you know, maybe do it, maybe not. So yeah. And it's like, I'm definitely guilty of overly pros, you know, overly talking my products. So I have to watch out for that.
I think everyone is. So let's talk a little bit about Guardian Circle. I was telling you before we started that, like, I feel like this is your guy's Super Bowl, right? So we've got a pandemic. Yes, literally. We've got a pandemic that occurred that led to this economic shock. And now we've got social unrest in all 50 states and even internationally. And so maybe just give us a kind of overview of, like, what is Guardian Circle? And then we can kind of talk about, like, why it's important given the timing right now.
Yeah. So Guardian Circle is friends and family 911 or community emergency response. So the idea is you download our app and you get your friends, family, neighbors to also download it. And then you connect as guardians in the system. Both of you have to opt in. It's like being friends on Facebook, right? And one of you can not guard the other at any moment you want. When you're in trouble, you hit an alert button. So the idea is push a button, help comes. So signal goes out to all your guardians. Their phones start exploding with this evil klaxon sound, which is good because it's an alert and this is an emergency. And then when they answer that alert, everyone is brought into a shared map and chat room. So in, you know, under 30 seconds, everybody knows where everybody else is and everybody can talk to everybody else. And this is the important part. This is true whether those people knew each other beforehand or not. They all know you, but they don't know each other. But getting your mom and your neighbor talking during your emergency, difference between life and death, possibly, right? So that's the basic idea.
And so what are the scenarios in which you guys kind of see this being most helpful? Is this like, hey, I'm drunk and I'm lost? Or is this a thing where I've gotten a really serious car accident? Like, help me understand kind of the situations where you guys foresee this being used.
Yeah. So, well, I can tell you the situation that inspired it, which is a great example. My girlfriend had a stroke. And she's fine. I like to say that right away. But she works out of her garage. She was all alone and she couldn't type and she was trying to dial the phone. Like her brain just wasn't working. Right. So she could have pushed a button, but that was kind of it. And, I happened to come home at a weird time and I found her and brought her to the hospital and, you know, it all worked out. But afterwards I started thinking about this. I'm like, my God, like if I hadn't gotten there in time, strokes are like time dependent. If too much time passes, you're paralyzed or you're dead. So, you know, and I realized, and when I reversed engineered the situation, that there was all kinds of help all around her. Her neighbor was home. Several people had been driving by. You know, in short, there were seven people within 1,000 yards of her during the course of the emergency. She was drowning in help, but she had no way to get to it. So, and I was like, well, if somebody could just push the button, I started thinking about Guardian Circle, right? Somebody pushed the button, then, you know, and somehow we could have an Uber-like screen where instead of cars coming, humans were alerted and could coordinate, then this would, you know, your network is closest and can help you fastest kind of thing, right? So that was the original. It was really about health things initially. And then as we started showing it to people, we did show it. There's a place called Crypto Blockchain Plug here in LA, and it's sort of, you know, it's in the inner city. So a lot of folks there are scared to call the cops. They're like, we don't call unless, you know, somebody's arm is chopped off, then okay. But other than that, no. They'd rather sort of handle things themselves. So anyone that likes neighborhood watch kinds of things for whatever reason, it's very appealing to them. If you're in a remote area where the cops can't get to you, it's also very, right? It's not really a practical option. Call the cops, they're gonna be here in an hour, right? That doesn't really help you. So, and then finally, women's safety is a big concern that a lot of people think of with this. So we, you know, the XPRIZE people, when they found out what we were doing, they were doing a women's safety XPRIZE to protect women in India. And, you know, there the cops, when the cops come, the cops usually assault the woman also. So, right, which is just insane, right? But so the answer is not more cops, right? So, you know, in India, they already know kind of what America is now knowing for the first time. They've known it for, you know, a long time that you can't rely totally on the police. So, you know, there's, you know, the women's safety, a lot of jobs that women are alone and possibly going to be isolated by a creepy guy, real estate agents, hotel housekeepers. It's a big problem for hotel housekeepers. In fact, there are now panic button laws that are coming out nationwide requiring hotels to buy products like, you know, what Guardian Circle has. And we are now selling into that market. We're just starting to sell into that market ourselves. So, you know, kind of a wide range of things. But you're right that before all of this COVID and other things, when we told people about Guardian Circle, our pitch was kind of like 911's not good enough in a lot of ways. They don't know, you know, they don't know your location when you call from a mobile device. There are problems with 911, but most people feel like 911 is safe, right? If you're in America, you're like, yeah, I'm good. I just call 911, I'm fine. And we had a hard time kind of getting a lot of people to, you know, people don't like to think about emergencies. So getting on their radar was just tough, right? Unless they already were someone that was at risk, elderly, a woman who's been assaulted, who, you know, was just afraid of it happening again. If it was on your mind in some way, it was easier. But other than that, it was difficult. Over the last couple of weeks, like 3-4, you know, COVID, obviously, but the last week in particular, you know, getting people to think about emergencies is no longer a marketing challenge, right? So that has suddenly shifted the dynamic, and now people are seeking us out instead of us seeking them out. So yeah.
And it's the thought process that it's not like there's kind of two camps, right? One is like, hey, the COVID crisis has made me think much more about those around me, my community, all that kind of stuff. But then two is a lot of the social unrest around police brutality and things like that. Like, I'm fascinated with the idea of creating multiple layers when it comes to community kind of protection, right? So you mentioned kind of neighborhood watch is the least lethal, easiest kind of loosely organized group, all the way on up to we have a military that protects the United States, right? And there's a whole bunch of steps in there. What you guys have basically done is use technology to create the equivalent of really kind of a neighborhood watch that's technology enabled. And to me, the part that's really interesting is I don't need to know the other people. Right. Like all we have to do is just be connected. If I know you and somebody else knows you and you're in trouble, then all of a sudden we're, you know, me and that person are on the same team, right? We're here to help you. And so putting us into some kind of chat is a pretty interesting dynamic where you almost create these like ephemeral social network graphs, right, around a person.
Yeah. The emergency world has a name for it. They call it dynamic group management or regrouping. So, but yes, that means exactly what you just said. And that is one of the key problems to solve an emergency response is getting all these people communicating immediately that can clear up the fog of war, if you will, around the emergency. These people don't have each other's phone numbers. They don't know each other's names. They typically have no way to communicate or anything that puts them into communication. So we found it's kind of a hard problem to explain to someone. But during your emergency, you're like, oh shit, I really wish X, Y, and Z to talk to one another right now. It's kind of the top problem. So yeah, it's a big deal.
For sure. And then I guess kind of how do you see the acquisition of users going here, right? So like obviously before you had this whole thing where you had to convince people there's a problem and they had to use the technology. Now they're convinced. Like what do you see kind of the change when it comes to the acquisition and marketing?
Yeah, so I want to touch on one thing you said earlier because it just reminded me of something I didn't say. When we first started this thing, I thought of it as a CDN of help, right? So just like Akamai, they have peers at the edge of the network closest to where the bits need to be delivered. And 90% of the time, that's much more efficient. But that doesn't, that doesn't get rid of Amazon. That doesn't get rid of centralized servers. You still need those. The CDN is a boost, is like a booster rocket, right? And so in the same way, Guardian Circle was not meant to replace the police. It's a CDN of help. You know, your network is closest and can help you fastest, like a CDN. But I never imagined that like people would be like, yeah, you know what, get rid of the cops totally. We'll just do this. I'm like, you guys are going further even than I would. You know, I'm still in CDN of help world. The defund the police thing, and I think it's a moment. I don't think we'll end up truly with no police forces around the country. I don't think it's going to go there. But I do think we'll end up somewhere more in the middle. So we have changed our marketing. You know, you've probably seen some of my tweets where I've just been tweeting things out like, you know, if things get crazier, this could help. And I have to be careful about how I say it too, because I don't want, you know, there's a lot of people who are trying to profit off of this. And yes, we're trying to market into it, but we don't want to seem ghoulish. But the fact is, we've worked for 4 years on a product which is perfect for this moment and can save lives. So, you know, yes, we're going to market it. I think it's okay. I don't think there's any moral qualm about doing that. But I do have to be respectful about how I do it, right? So, you know, thinking through, you know, the tweet very, very carefully to make sure there's no way it could be misinterpreted or taken the wrong way. That's changed. I'm a bit more tiptoey about things. So
yeah, and on the defund the police and demilitarize the police, or actually disband the police, which is the new one for me. To me, it's kind of this weird situation where it would be hard to argue that the police has not become militarized. So the idea of like, hey, maybe they shouldn't be walking around with weapons of war. Okay, like I think some people, you know, that's not that hard to get there. When it comes to things like defund, which in New York City, they're talking about taking away one of the $6 billion in their budget. Okay, so you got to make some hard decisions. That happens to every business, like got it. Where I think that, you know, you're kind of hinting at and is going to be a hard leap for people is like the disbanding of the police, right? And what I said to somebody the other day, and actually I think I tweeted it, was, look, if you want to disband the police, you better be like the biggest Second Amendment fan in the world, right? Because it, like, who are you going to call if you can't defend yourself and you can't call somebody to defend you either, right? You get in this weird world. So I think that it's more like the either smaller budgets or demilitarization is likely where we end up, which gives opportunity, I think, for things like this, right? That can kind of provide more of the safety component rather than the like, hey, there's somebody who just robbed me is running down the street with a gun. Like, I don't know if I'm calling my neighbor as much as I'm calling the police, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so Guardian Circle can provide a much bigger buffer zone between, you know, the guys with the guns and all these problems in between that could be solved by a lot of other people, right? So, you know, I think we have a much bigger role. I think where this will end up is somewhere in the middle, and there will be a much bigger role for things like Guardian Circle and, you know, a layer of community emergency response that doesn't fully replace the police, but you go through that first before, okay, this is bad enough, we'll call the cops. But I think if you get, you know, to your point, if you get rid of the police, you know, ultimately that just creates a power vacuum, and that will be filled by mafias and gangs. Like, that's where that will go, because people, you know, then, you know, this thing gets crazier. People will be like, someone save us. And that's when the mafia and the gangs be like, well, you know, we'll save you, but, you know, cost you a little money, right? You know, that'll happen, right? That's where it'll go. So
look, ask any soldier if they went to Iraq or Afghanistan. They will tell you that many people in those communities, not all of them, but many people in those communities will say, hey, when the Taliban, you know, looked over our village, it sucked. They were super violent, but there was law and order, right? And all of a sudden, when you guys went and ran them out of here, there's now this power vacuum. And yes, we're trying to replace it with democracy and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so that transition period is actually very weird for those people, right? Because they're used to kind of a very rigid kind of oversight. Obviously, when you come at it from democratic ideals like we do, we say, hey, well, you know, look, there's a better path, right? Let us help you do that. But I definitely agree that, you know, when you have that power vacuum, what happens is people that you probably don't want being in charge end up being in charge, right?
Yeah, that's where it'll go. So it's unfortunate. Democracy is hard and law and order is hard, right? And I, you know, the pendulum is really, it's swung very far in one direction right now. So emotions are high. And while there's a huge, there's absolutely a point behind where the emotions are right now, we're not thinking about the logical consequences of where that thinking goes yet. I don't think in full. So yeah.
What do you think is the biggest risk, right? Because like I always find it interesting when timing lines up, right? So you've built a product now in kind of the more macro environment. It's like, bam, like, okay, everyone's paying attention right now. Hey, we're going to roll this product right into this great timing. How do you think about risk during this time? So you mentioned one on like the marketing message and more kind of like people misconstruing or seeing something as insensitive. What are the other risks that you see?
Yeah, I mean, for us, you know, it really took us 4 years to get to what I call, you know, in my mind is the 1.0 version of the product. So, and that was, it's really our 3.1 version. And that came out in kind of the end of last year. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And a part of it is money. So, you know, we did do a token sale. So we do have a token called Guard, and there's a wallet inside of the app, and you earn tokens for referring people into the network. So the more you help build the safety network, the more you earn. So so for us, you know, the risk had been getting too much publicity before we were ready. Now we're ready. Now we're scalable. Everything's good. So the timing just weirdly worked out perfectly on all of that. But at the same time, you know, Guardian Circle is a free service. It doesn't make any money. Which is fine. It doesn't cost a lot for us to run it. So it's not like WeWork or Uber where we're spending gobs of cash. It's not that. But we need to either raise money or we need to have some revenue coming in. So the risk right now is the Mike Moritz risk, right? Of you know, diverging our focus. So we did have some funding lined up in March, which I won't go into the details of that, but bottom line is it was about 5 million and it fell through because of COVID and the market. You know, anytime the market crashes, venture capitalists, you know, kind of their limited partners are like, no, we're not going to give you our money after all. Right. So there was a fund closing and it didn't happen and blah, blah, blah. So then we said, all right, well, we have to do a revenue product. And we looked at a consumer revenue product And what we discovered was it was probably too early for that. It was a great time to grow the free product. But where the actual money is in the hotel housekeeping business. So like I said before, there are panic button laws coming into effect right now, which require hotels to provide housemaids with panic button service. And it's a law in Vegas. There's a California law that looks like it's going to pass. And there's a few places, a few cities around the United States, but it does look like the sort of thing that's going to go nationwide. And in aggregate, it's probably about a $1 billion market in the U.S. Worldwide, it's like 5 or 6 billion, something like that. So there's money there, and it's a special case of Guardian Circle. So we're building a new product based on Guardian Circle, and that effort's been underway for a couple of weeks now, and it's almost done. So that's the good news. I was actually afraid that this might be, a 6 month build or something stupid like that. There's some modifications we have to make to the product because, if you're in a hotel, GPS doesn't work right. You can't really rely on GPS. So, it's sort of a combination of Bluetooth and NFC tags, not NFT, NFC, NFC tags. So some other technologies that have to be brought into play. But the API that we made for the devices for the XPRIZE, that API is now reusable in this context. So a lot of the sort of ladders that we put down for ourselves, we're climbing up right now, right? Without realizing, we didn't know when we were putting those ladders down how we would use them, but they've turned out to be very useful now. But the danger is that we'll have a bifurcated bite. We'll have two focuses at once. We'll have the hotel business and the free product. And if we're sort of serving two masters, that will eventually, which we are right now, I'm consciously knowing that we're doing it, but at a certain point that will become dangerous for all the reasons Mike Moritz pointed out. So right now, that's my biggest fear.
Yeah. And then how has it been kind of navigating this while running a company, right? So you mentioned kind of the challenges with the fundraising side, but how have other things around building a product and managing a business kind of changed due to the COVID crisis?
We had become a crypto company kind of around 2017 or so. And we were already working from home. So nothing changed there. We never had an office, right? But I was basically living out of hotels and planes for a good year and a half, kind of, at kind of a crazy pace. I mean, in my life, there was regular life, and then there was internet time, regular time, the internet time, then there was crypto time, right? Which was sort of even more fast and more furious. And now there's COVID time, which is like another crank in the ratchet. But we were already working from home, but I'm no longer traveling. So that has changed. I actually think it played to our strengths because the rest of the world started acting like we already were. And I've heard this a lot. We're already a distributed team. We're already at home. So we didn't have to reinvent ourselves, whereas most of the rest of the world did. So the only thing that did change is I stopped traveling like a crazy man. So, which is probably good. I'm not sure what else to say other than that.
No, it makes sense. And then I guess also, like, as you guys continue to build the technology, how do you think about kind of the international market versus the domestic market? And you mentioned kind of the India, endeavor, but one of the things I've become more and more interested in is as people are forced to go inside due to COVID, they spend more time on the internet. And what you actually get is you get a lot more continuity in the content people are consuming, the conversations they're having, right? Like you now, let's say that you used to go and have 10 conversations a day and 8 of those were in your local community, whether it was at a coffee shop, at the office, whatever it was non-digital, right? And 2 of them were digital. And I'm making up kind of percentages here, right? Or numbers.
Yeah.
But now if all of a sudden 9 out of 10 conversations are done online, like the geographic barriers don't matter as much. And so you actually end up kind of colliding more and spending more time talking to people in other geographies, whether they're domestic or international. And so how do you guys think about marketing the product to international markets versus domestically? And do you see a change there based on this idea of like more people are living in kind of the digital economy than the analog one right now?
Yeah. So there absolutely is a difference between marketing Guardian Circle internationally and domestically. Internationally, it's largely on Android. And, you know, making an app for Android is just a giant pain in the ass. You've probably heard this a bunch of times, but, you know, you got all these different makes and models, all these different screen sizes, all the different handsets are running different versions of Android. You know, you get different carriers, and it is just a madhouse. And so, you know, that was one of the reasons why it took us so long to get the product in shape, because we were dealing with all those problems. And there's also different sensibilities for what people will accept in terms of permissions. So we went through a lot of different versions of the onboarding process, specifically because internationally, a lot of people were not getting their login code because SMS is, not that reliable outside the United States. So we had to, put things in like robocalls and other ways of getting that information. We even got it enabled. We haven't released this yet, but we did get it enabled on, and I always get this wrong, WeChat or whatever one of those is the most popular one worldwide, we're on that. But most of those people don't like giving up, access to their contacts. However, we used to have a version. So when you log into Guardian Circle, we ask for access to your contacts so that we can help you invite them to be Guardians. And we used to not do this. And we found that when we didn't do it, people just couldn't, if we didn't hold people by the hand and do everything for them that we could, they'd never ended up inviting people to be Guardians. That was very difficult, even if, they got into the system. So we created an in-app contact manager and an in-app invite system, which is now excruciatingly easy and wizard-like. And it took us a long time to get there. But a lot of people internationally just don't like that. They're like, nope, I'm afraid of this for one reason or another. However, we've discovered that Americans are not. Americans are just like, yep, I don't care, fine, whatever. Great. And the Americans are much, I would say, healthier Guardian Circle users. All of them have at least three Guardians for the most part. And even the ones that don't have, that have less than that, they've invited like five or six people, right? So the behavior is that they are trying to they're trying to generate more users at all times. And they're trying out the alerts, they're doing practice alerts. So they get it. And there are pockets of the world that do get it, but by and large, it's been more difficult to kind of get it out to them. So the latest version, so we just made a version of Guardian Circle because of the international users, which is now the mainstream version, where we actually don't require access to your contacts, but you can't send out invites to people. You can only receive them. But once you are guarded up with someone, you can send alerts to them and they can send alerts to you. So the product is fully functional except for the outbound invite portion of it. So, and to be clear also, the other big thing we ran into was both domestically and internationally, when we didn't do the contact manager and sort of cleanse the contacts, there is a lot of bad data in people's contact manager, just tons of it. And they just don't think about it. So they would send out invites to landlines and then call us and be like, it's not working, your product sucks. And then we figure out, oh, you're sending an SMS message to a landline. That's why, right? But people just, it's not in their nature to sort of, you have to do those things for them. So, and that's true. That's unfortunately true of Americans as well as people internationally. So,
yeah, it's super interesting to me too, how you start thinking about like the cohort analysis around, how valuable is a user that's got three people who they've connected with versus five versus one, and internationally versus domestically. Like, you can really kind of dig into this. And part of this is when you have almost these like micro social networks to some degree, really what you're doing is you're trying to find who's the person who's the most connected, who also is most bought into the mission, right? Because if they're bought in and they've got a large network, then they can kind of pull a bunch of users with them. And I've seen a lot of companies who successfully have done that. And then others who they knew that's what they needed to do. They just were unsuccessful in being able to locate, who's that person who their social group will actually follow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing is with Guardian Circle, let me start here. For LinkedIn or Facebook or MySpace or whatever, in order for it to be valuable, there have to be a lot of people on it, right? So you don't go to it. It's like a nightclub, right? You don't go to it unless a lot of other people are there, right? So, in our universe, Guardian Circle is 100% useful if you have two to five Guardians. It doesn't matter how many people are on Guardian Circle. You still have 2 to 5 Guardians. You're not really interacting with anyone else. So in that respect, we're not really chasing the people that have like millions of followers, like if we were Twitter or Instagram or something like that. But for those people, I mean, one of the reasons we did the Guard referral program is to give those people links. So as they recruit people, you don't have to be Guardians with them. You just have to, if they use your link and get it in the system, you earn Guard for doing it. So, you know, that's one way we're trying to engage with that, I guess. But other than that, not really.
Yeah. Where can people go find more about Guardian Circle?
Well, we are at guardianscircle.com. And, you know, our Twitter handle is at Guardian Circle. So we're pretty easy to find, and we've been pretty good about being very visible, I think. So yeah, there it is.
Got it. And then I wrap up every episode with the same two questions. The first one is a super serious one, which is what's the most important book that you've ever read?
If we're talking about business, I'm a big fiction. Well, you know, I write novels, so obviously I love fiction. So. That's one answer, but I won't get into that. Well, I'll get into it real quick. So I love this series of books called The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, the Unbeliever. And you know, the plot is basically Lord of the Rings, except in the 70s, a guy from our world hits his head and goes into this fantasy realm, and he's like the Frodo, right? And his wedding ring is the ring. So, and it's very, very well crafted and very well done. I've always loved those books since I was a kid. But in terms of business, I have to say Crossing the Chasm, it's an old one, but still in my mind, the best one. I also really like 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. That I also found, that was one of the best books I've ever read. And, you know, Crossing the Chasm has got one idea in it, and it basically says, you know, pick one thing and do it better than everyone else in the world, which kind of lines up with what Moritz said from Sequoia. So it's a very hard lesson to learn. That is, you know, it's easy to read and be like, oh yeah, I get that. And then you turn right around and start not doing it, right? So it's hard to put into practice. So yeah,
for sure.
It's a deep dive.
It's one of these things where when you're reminded, you're like, duh, but it's easy to lose track of it day to day. Last question, which is a more fun one, is about aliens, believer or non-believer?
Oh, absolutely a believer. No question.
Why?
The universe... The universe is just here. It's here to generate life. I mean, I feel like, I know it's sort of a non-scientific thing, but it feels to me that like there'd be no reason for the universe unless it were here to generate life and consciousness. And so I have no proof, but it is my very, very, very strong gut that life is just everywhere. And this idea we have about dead planets and, you know, spinning around dead suns, and there's a lot of that. And that's most of what's going on. My gut says no, I just don't buy it. So aliens, absolutely yes.
I love it. This up.
Okay.
What one question do you have for me to finish this up?
What is the most interesting crypto project other than a coin, like a dApp? That you have seen lately? Like what's exciting you right now? Is there anything, or is it, you just kind of watching?
I mean, I am notorious for you. Just Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Bitcoin. You know, look, we've made a bunch of investments in different companies. I won't play favorites among all of the children, if you will, but, yeah, but totally. By far, I mean, Bitcoin is so, you know, head and shoulders above everything else. And really from a global importance standpoint, in my opinion, right? If this ends up doing what we think it should do in terms of assuming a certain role in the world, it'll be one of the greatest technological innovations, you know, in human history, let alone in our lifetimes. And so I think that it's just really, really crazy that we get to live through this.
Yeah, I agree. Bitcoin, I still say that it's more important than the internet. And you know, look, if software's eating the world and it's mostly the internet ate like, you know, retail, books, movies, telecommunications, and then that's kind of it. I mean, that's not nothing. That's a lot, but that's kind of it. You know, whereas Bitcoin, you know, maybe all of crypto, maybe Bitcoin, but in some form, crypto is going to eat world law, finance, banking, reserve currencies, right? that meal is just orders of magnitude, orders and orders of magnitude larger than what the internet ate. So yes, I think it's more important than the internet ultimately.
I love it. I love it. All right, Mark, listen, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I think that people will learn a lot here, and we'll send them to go check out Guardian Circle, but we'll have to do it again in the future.
Really appreciate it. Thanks, Bob.